You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here. Jamal Collier joining us, our MLB.com Nationals reporter. We are talking middle infield as far as this Nationals team goes heading into 2017. Jamal, and nothing like some good timing as we record this podcast, just maybe an hour after Stephen Drew officially signs to return to the Nationals on a one-year deal. Drew played 70 games with the Nats in 2016. He really served an effective role as that backup infielder, and at this point in his career, I think you pretty much know what you're getting with Stephen Drew.
Yeah, shout out to Mike Rizzo for looking out for us on the podcast. Matter of fact, and getting this deal done today. This was a kind of a deal that they was really important for them to do, and they kind of had to get done. Drew, obviously, after coming off a strong year, was trying to see if he could land somewhere for a starting role next season, and of course, that's his right. But when the market really hasn't developed at all for a lot of players, especially a lefty middle infielder, so brings Drew kind of back to the Nats, a one-year deal. And for them, you know, they really needed just some depth. We'll talk a little bit about their middle infielders here in a minute. But, you know, a guy like Daniel Murphy, who had the hamstring problems last year, that he said that's kind of a thing that you're going to have to monitor, and it could be reoccurring. So, I mean, he hasn't played 150 games since in a season since 2013. So he's a guy who you can almost kind of pencil down that maybe for about 2 weeks or so is going to just kind of be sidelined or going to have to sit him or something. Then you got a guy like Trey Turner, who's a rookie, who's playing shortstop for the first time. So it was really important to have some depth off the bench and for the middle infield. And you had Wilmer Defoe before today as the only other backup middle infielder on the roster. And Defoe is a nice player, and they like him a lot. But to kind of put that burden on a guy who's never done that role, coming off the bench and having to move so many different positions, would have just been such an unknown for them. So the Drew deal made a whole lot of sense. They were kind of interested in him from the beginning of the offseason, and they got it done.
All right, let's move on to those other guys that you mentioned. And I want to start with Trey Turner because he's the new face there. Obviously not a new face to this team. He was so effective last year out in center field. But now he gets to return to his, we'll call it his natural position, although he took well to center field. He made some nice plays out there. Now, while it's his natural position playing shortstop, there's no question that the team had some doubts about his ability to be able to stay there at the major league level a year ago. So how much more confident are they now? Obviously, Danny Espinosa is no longer with the team, and it's Turner's job. So how high is the confidence, not offensively but defensively, for Turner at short?
I think it remains to be seen, just to see exactly what they're going to get with him. They like a lot of the tools that makes him. He's so athletic. He's going to have good range because he's going to get to a lot of balls. So because he's going to get to so many balls, you're going to also see that he'll probably make some errors that other shortstops really wouldn't get charged with because they just wouldn't even reach the ball that you know, Trey will get to. So it's going to be just kind of how he responds to some of the mistakes that he may make or some of the things that may not go well at times at shortstop. And as a matter of fact, as a guy who you think, when you think about what he did last year and going to the outfield after never playing center field and having a crash course in the minors basically about a week and having to be becoming a starting center fielder and leadoff hitter, he's a guy that can respond to mistakes and can kind of fix those things, you know, on the fly. And Dusty Baker, I think, mentioned this a couple of times last year. One of the things that he was most impressed with Trey Turner was you didn't have to tell him the same thing twice. You told him something about an adjustment or something that he had to kind of correct. He corrected it, moved on, and that was it. It was kind of a lingering thing. So, you know, will he be perfect defensively? Definitely not. He's going to definitely be a downgrade over what Espinosa was, who was so good defensively last year. But it's going to be a bit of a learning curve up the middle with them for him and defensively. But they seem committed to letting him, you know, figure it out. And he's a guy who obviously, you know, his offense and the numbers that he put up kind of was so good in that short sample last year for the half season. That if he hits that well and plays that way and is that dynamic at the top of their order, then I think they'll live with some of those mistakes.
You mentioned the offense and how good he was a year ago. And then when you think about the fact that he did all that while kind of learning a new position in his first real time in the big leagues, I mean, it's kind of remarkable. You would think a guy that's focusing so much on figuring stuff out defensively would maybe struggle offensively, but he had no issues at all. And does that speak to what he could be this year offensively? Maybe he's even better because he's back playing shortstop where he's a little more comfortable?
It was really impressive what he did last year. I mean, you know, the numbers, he slugged like Mike Trout. He stole bases like Billy Hamilton. He, you know, he hit 340. He had a 9-something OPS. It just was kind of just the perfect storm of a player, and it might be unfair for him to just look at those numbers and, you know, 79 games, I believe it was, and you just double those and see what he can necessarily do, which would put you at about 70 stolen bases and 25 home runs or whatever. But it's tough to exactly know where his expectations is. One of the things I actually was kind of interested in is that his slugging percentage was about 5-something last year. You kind of think, you know, he's not a guy necessarily known for his power. He has the power. He probably can hit 20 home runs in the major leagues at some point, but, you know, probably looking at a guy who's going to hit 10 to 15 home runs just in general. But he might have a high slugging percentage just in general because he's a guy who obviously can extend everything with his feet, and he can turn singles into doubles into triples, and those things obviously count toward his slugging percentage. So I kind of expect that number to be pretty high, and he's shown, you know, he hits fastballs, he can get on base. It's tough to exactly figure out where he's going to be, but I think he's going to be somewhere similar to what we saw, you know, in that short sample last year. Now the league's going to adjust to him, and it's going to, of course, be up to him to kind of continue to make adjustments and to figure it out. We saw the Dodgers a little bit in the playoff series kind of threw him a lot of breaking stuff early on. But by the end of that, you know, it was only a 5-game series, but by games 4 and 5, he looked a lot better at the plate, a lot more comfortable handling some of those curveballs than he did in games 1, 2, and 3, really. So, it's going to be a constant adjustment for him to see, but I think that, you know, the guy who was the you know, second rookie of the year and was so good for them last year, that's pretty much the kind of player that they're expecting and you think that's going to be for Trey Turner this year and going forward.
And then obviously at second base, Daniel Murphy outplayed any possible expectations people could have had for him signing, obviously, as a kind of a second choice for the Nationals that turned out to be MVP candidate throughout the season and really put this team on his back at times. The good thing about the scary thing about Murphy is you think maybe there'd be some regression there because of how good he was. But then on the other hand, it seems like ever since midway through 2015, something kind of clicked with Murphy where you think that this is actually who he is and who he's going to be for the next few years.
And I think that's just it, that, you know, anybody looking at these numbers from last year and thinking they were a fluke, you know, it's kind of mistaken because he definitely is a different player than the Daniel Murphy of, you know, the years before. You can kind of throw those numbers essentially out and say that we're going to probably see something closer to what he was in 2016. Now, I expect some regression just because, you know, how can he be? You never expect anybody to hit hit 340 with a 950 something OPS and 25 homers. You know, those numbers you kind of just expect to come down a little bit. But I would not expect anything drastically different from Murphy. He just really knows exactly what he wants to do with the plate. Has such a great approach and such a great work ethic, I should say, about kind of how he goes about his business at the plate. And yeah, he's really remade himself into just a completely different player than what he was before. I think that you can kind of take what he did, you know, the last year and a half or so, and that's how you should use those numbers to project what you'll see from Murphy. A guy who's going to hit for a high average, is going to make a lot of contact, and he's got some power to necessarily drive in 20, 25 home runs again.
We mentioned Steven Drew, obviously, off the top and what his role will be. That role seemed like it was destined to maybe be Wilmer Defoe as that backup guy up the middle. So with the addition of Steven Drew, what does that mean for Defoe? Does he still have a spot on this roster, barring an injury? Or, you know, is he going to have to start the year in the minors? Where does he sit?
It's going to be tough, I think, for him to necessarily start the year in the majors. I think he's going to be a guy who they like a lot, and they'd like to also kind of get him working at third base and make him a little bit of a utility guy as well. So, I mean, I think that's an easier thing to do in the minors. You know, also, you can kind of move him around and play him every day and get him some reps there. But he's a guy who's going to have that versatility where you can kind of you have options, whether you can call him up and down, you can move him around the infield if, you know, depending on if you have injuries or need him for those kind of situations. So right now the bench looks pretty set when you look at where we got Drew, Chris Heisey, and Clint Robinson, Lobatone, and then probably a fifth spot is probably going to be for some kind of reserve fourth outfielder. Maybe Michael Taylor, maybe Brian Goodwin. But so Defoe might not have a spot necessarily on the opening day roster, but I could guess that he's going to be in the majors kind of a significant portion of 2017 and get some playing time somehow.
One more thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, Jamal. You have a story on Nationals.com looking back on basically the best free agent signing the Nationals have made over their time in D.C., and Jason Wirth gets the nod. Obviously, Daniel Murphy was incredible, too, but that's only 1 year we can kind of look at this point, whereas Wirth has been longer term. And Worth has been very good on the field, but it seemed like he also just made a change for this franchise, and that it went from a struggling franchise that had had some high draft picks to a spot that could be a destination for free agents, and they really turned the corner after his arrival.
And I think that's just it. I'm not usually one for, you know, symbolic gestures or clubhouse guys, because, you know, the kind of the thing is, these guys don't produce, then it kind of doesn't really matter a whole lot. And Worth has been a productive player, and has had some really good years, as a matter of fact, too, early on in his contract. But you can basically draw a before and after to before Jason Worth signed and after he signed. And when he did, the deal was, you know, looking just back on it, when it first happened, everybody was kind of puzzled for both sides and puzzled to why would the Nats, you know, commit this much money to this guy who was turning 33 at the time. And why would Jason Worth want to sign with this team who's coming off back-to-back 100 lost seasons? And really from there, it just kind of transformed this team into the team that's won three divisions in the past 5 years. He's given them he's obviously just been a presence and a leader as far as the team on the field and in the clubhouse. And he's kind of become one of the faces of this team and of this franchise since baseball has kind of been revived here in the city. So I think he was an easy choice for just necessarily the best free agent signing right now. You know, you talked about Murphy's really early in his contract. Max Scherzer really early in his contract. But I was out to the great start winning the Cy Young this year. Potentially in a couple of years down the road, we may revisit that because Max could be, you know, closing in on a Hall of Fame career. Murphy could have, you know, he may win the next two MVPs the way he looked last year. But the symbolism that Worth had necessarily in transforming this team and the production that he's also put up there in some big playoff moments. And some of the most memorable post-game interviews as well with the Nats I think Worth was kind of the easy choice. It's one of the most important kind of signings and moments for this franchise to get them to where they are right now.
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with Anthony DiComo as we continue to get you ready for the 2017 Mets season by taking you around the Mets roster. A week ago, we handled the corner infield. This week, we move up the middle, shortstop and second base, and this familiar guys there that came over a year ago and were such a big part of the Mets in 2016. That's Asdrubal Cabrera at short and Neil Walker at second, and they're both back for another go-around. As far as Walker goes, Anthony, obviously he accepts the qualifying offer, so he'll be well paid in 2017. But I think the Mets were, while they would have gone for the pick that they would have gotten if Walker had decided to leave, it's nice to know you have that guy at second base, that veteran guy who really had one of his best years as a professional with the Mets in 2016 until he got hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Sandy Alderson gets criticized sometimes for looking more at certain individual aspects of a player and ignoring other things. But Neil Walker is a guy who Sandy Alderson has really credited vocally for being, for his intangibles, for being a clubhouse leader, for being a guy that the Mets could rely on. And really before he got hurt, the Mets and Neil Walker were both talking about mutual interest in doing a long-term contract extension, which you know, would have been a nice thing for both sides to have. Now the injury interfered and that didn't take place, but I think the fact that Neil Walker did accept the qualifying offer really is telling in that he wanted to be back. Certainly the Mets wanted him back and liked the idea of having him back on a one-year deal, even if it is a bit of an expensive one at $17.2 million. This is a guy who did a lot of nice things for the Mets while he was here. Certainly his April was one of the best months of Neil Walker's career. He helped carry the Mets for a lot of that month. He hit 9 home runs. He hit over 300, I believe. And was just a real rock-solid player for the Mets. Now he's going to be back, and like so many players that we've talked about on this podcast, yes, there are questions surrounding Neil Walker. He had back surgery. That's not an easy thing to come back from. A lot of players struggle to come back from it. A lot of players come back from it and are just fine, and the Mets certainly hope that Neil Walker will be in that camp. I think one of the things you're going to have to look at with the Mets and with Neil Walker this year is just giving him a little more rest, giving him a little more off days. When Neil Walker first came over last year, there was talk that while he's a switch hitter, had never really been that good in his career against left-handed pitchers, batting from the right side, and there was talk that, you know, maybe he would be kind of a platoon guy at second base. Well, Neil Walker wound up having a great early season against left-handed pitchers, hit them about as well, if not better, than he did right-handed pitchers, and those off days never really materialized. Well, Neil Walker's a year older now. He's got those back problems. I think the Mets and Terry Collins need to be a little more vigilant in giving him a little bit of off time. They have Wilmer Flores back there as a potential platoon partner to do that. They have TJ Rivera, who did a very nice job for the Mets down the stretch in September, and I think the Mets kind of need to rely on those resources just a little bit more in making sure that Neil Walker is healthy and stays on the field, because he's as integral a part of this offense as just about anyone.
You mentioned TJ Rivera. How does he fit into this roster? Is he a lock to make this team on opening day? Is he going to have to battle for a spot in spring training?
That's a great question. I think TJ Rivera would love the answer to that one. I don't think he's a lock, and maybe that's a little bit unfair because he was super productive last year. Certainly has nothing left to prove in the minor leagues after the season that he had at AAA last year. The batting title, the Pacific Coast League batting title and all that. But the Mets have Neil Walker and Asdrubal Cabrera, who are entrenched in the middle infield. They've got Jose Reyes as a backup. They've got Wilmer Flores as a backup. So there's not a ton of room there when you're looking at spots for TJ Rivera. I think ultimately he's probably, barring injury, going to have to start out again back in the minors. But you know, as we've seen so many times, there are so many injury questions with this team. The odds of getting through a full summer with everyone healthy or even close to it are slim to none. So I do think TJ Rivera will play an important role for the Mets before all is said and done. It just might not happen on opening day.
All right, and then over at shortstop, Asdrubal Cabrera had some huge hits for the Mets in 2016, was a steady force there at short. He's getting older. Is he a similar position where you got to make sure you can work those days off in, and Terry Collins is really going to have to juggle this lineup as a whole, I guess, with the amount of infielders that need days off?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's where Jose Reyes becomes so important. That's where Wilmer Flores becomes so important, because there are guys at every infield position that need days off. Now, in Asdrubal Cabrera's case, I don't think he receives quite enough credit for what he did down the stretch last year. He was one of the Mets' most important players. He was one of the Mets' most impactful players, and he was doing it all despite this knee injury that really affected him since April and got worse as the season went on and on and on. He had one of the Mets' biggest hits of the season, that walk-off home run, and again, the knee injury was affecting him all the while. So while the Mets were in a pennant race and they really didn't give Asdrubal Cabrera as many days off last year as he probably deserved and as he probably needed, he's another guy that they have to be vigilant about and they have to maybe be proactive about, and Terry Collins saying, look, I know you want to play, but I'm going to sit you down tonight and I'm going to play Jose Reyes instead, just to make sure you get him off those legs, you get him off that knee, which never required surgery, but certainly affected him to a great extent. Add in the fact that Asdrubal Cabrera is going to play in the World Baseball Classic. That's another few weeks of live game action that he will be in for. So, yeah, it's ultra important because, again, this is another, we talk about how important Neil Walker was. Asdrubal Cabrera was probably even more so to the Mets last year. A guy that I think his signing confused a lot of people last December. I don't think the Mets necessarily on paper needed him. And then all of a sudden he comes in and he becomes another guy who was a clubhouse leader, who was an offensive leader, who really picked things up around midseason and became one of the most productive shortstops in the league. And the Mets probably would not have made the playoffs without him. So he's an ultra-important guy. I believe he had 23 home runs last year, and if he can again approach that 20 home run mark, that's the type of production you don't necessarily see all the time from shortstops around the league anymore. The Mets need him to be healthy. They need him to be out there every day, and they need him again to be that two-hole hitter that he was so good at last year in 2016.
When you look to the future as far as this Mets team goes, and we have these all-aging infielders, Amed Rosario is currently ranked number 11 in baseball as far as MLBPipeline.com's top 100, and he'll likely make his way into the top 10 when those new rankings come out in the next couple of weeks. Double A in 2016. Is there any chance he finds his way up to the big leagues in 2017? Maybe even if it's just September, or are they going to take their time with Rosario and let him spend quality time at each level?
Yeah, it's certainly possible he's a September call-up. I don't envision him playing a significant role for the 2017 Mets, and that's more a testament to this guy's potential than anything else. Like you said, he'll almost certainly be a top 10 prospect when this year's lists come out. He might even be top five. He's got that kind of potential. He's the type of prospect the Mets really haven't seen on the position player side in a long, long time. Great bat, great glove. If he can develop a little more power, he could really become one of those exciting young prospects like we see around baseball for other teams, whether it's Carlos Correa or Francisco Lindor or any of those prospects who are really coming into their own in the big leagues. Rosario has that kind of talent. He's got that kind of makeup. The Mets love this kid. They love what he's all about. They think he can be a real superstar. So they're not going to rush him, certainly. He's been one of the youngest players at every minor league level he's been at along the ladder. That's going to continue this year in AAA. And if it means we don't see him until 2018, so be it. I think the Mets are more focused on Ahmed Rosario's development and making sure he has every opportunity to become the player that he has the potential to be. Because this is the type of guy you're talking about, you know, an aging infield. Well, he could be that infusion of youth, but not only that, he could be one of the best players on the New York Mets for the next decade or so.
So Ahmed Rosario, the future of the New York Mets infield, but probably not in 2017, but they have a veteran middle infield heading into 2017. Asdrubal Cabrera and Neil Walker hopefully will play most of the season and be a big part of this team's playoff push in 2017. That's it for us here on MLB.com Extras, our Mets edition. For Anthony DiComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Next week, we cover the Mets bullpen. Hey, everyone, we're talking Marlins baseball. I'm Tim McMaster, along with our MLB.com Marlins reporter, Joe Fusaro. And Joe, the Hall of Fame class of 2017 will include a Marlin, and that is Ivan Rodriguez. He spent that one season in Miami with the Marlins, Joe, but boy, it was a good one back in 2003 as they won the World Series. So of his 21 seasons, one of them in South Florida, but I would think Marlins fans still thrilled to see this guy get his due and head to Cooperstown on the first ballot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, part, you know, he kind of has ties to South Florida. He has a home here, or at least had. You know, it was a big year. You know, they got him on that one-year deal when back at a time when no one was kind of taking the one-year deals. He didn't get the big contract. The Marlins offer him 1 year, kind of shocked everybody. And, you know, he comes in, and like you say, what, 21 years, his one ring came as a Marlin. And, you know, when I thought back of all that he accomplished it, in that season, you know, he kind of started off a little rough that year. As the team got better, you know, he kind of got better. And, you know, his leadership and his production in the playoffs especially, were really telling, I think, back to the NLCS when he was the MVP of that series against the Cubs. Big hit after big hit. Go even before that to the division series. He had a couple of huge hits that helped them beat the Giants. And, of course, one of the most memorable plays in Marlins history, tagging out JT Snow while absorbing that pretty hard collision at the plate and holding the baseball up, cupping it in his hand in triumph. And then obviously, you know, embracing his teammates after Josh Beckett's, you know, gem in game six of the World Series. So, yeah, Pudge, a short tenure with the Marlins, but a legacy that's going to last the history of this franchise and in the minds of Marlins fans for a long, long time.
And that's a perfect segue for us, Joe, into our talk this week of the catchers on this roster as we continue to break down the Marlins roster heading into 2017. And this is a position that for years was there wasn't a true guy that you really you look to as the guy for this Marlins team since Pudge, obviously, way back in 2003. But JT Realmuto really took over the spot last year, and I think he was second best in the National League in WAR behind Buster Posey, or tied for second. Had a tremendous season to the point where now you can look at that catcher spot as a true strength for this Marlins team.
Oh, no question. And, you know, I did a little research on that around the horn story I did on catcher position. And, you know, since Pudge's year in 03, the Marlins have had 11 different opening day catchers in 14 years. And, you know, JT, barring anything bad happened to him in spring, you know, he will be the opening day catcher for the second year in a row. But, you know, Tim, this is a guy who is really unheralded, who I think, you know, baseball people know who he is. But I think, you know, the industry is going to start seeing a guy becoming an all-star caliber player. As you noted, you know, Buster Posey had a 4.0 WAR last year, tops among all NL catchers. JT Realmuto and Wilson Ramos, who now, of course, is at Tampa Bay, they both had 3.5. you know, WAR, that they were second. In terms of Marlin catchers who had 100, who played in 100 games or more, JT Realmuto is the only catcher to hit above 300. Pudge in his year hit 297. JT hits 303. His 152 hits or 154 hits last year, most ever by a Marlins catcher. You know, there's going to be a lot of firsts. You know, he's still, you know, in the controllable stages before he even reaches arbitration. I'm sure the team and will in the next few years make him an extremely high priority to lock up long term. But, you know, he's a different type of catcher, as, you know, we're starting to see a few more really athletic catchers, guys who can run, you know, guys that bring a little bit more to the table than the traditional catch and throw and then maybe hit for a little bit of power or something. But, you know, he's a converted quarterback out of high school. He was a shortstop in high school, got drafted as a shortstop. They made a really smart call initially by moving him behind the plate. And it looks like the Marlins got really one of the better fine catchers in the game.
Behind him will be A.J. Ellis, one of the Marlins signings in free agency this offseason. And there's a veteran presence there. And I guess there's two things you get there. Not only can JT Realmuto pick his brain, but you have a lot of young pitchers here, and they can be helped out as well. A.J. Ellis, will he be as important off the field as he is on the field for the Marlins?
Oh, no question. I mean, you know, Jeff, make no mistake, Jeff Mathis is a very valued guy. They got him in 13, and he was a mentor to JT and a complete leader in this clubhouse. And when, you know, they made the decision not to really strongly pursue Jeff, and Mathis signs with Arizona, a really good fallback to get A.J. Ellis, who, of course, played for Don Mattingly in L.A., has playoff experience. He kind of brings a lot of the same that Jeff Mathis does in terms of being just a real pro's pro, probably not the defensive catcher that Mathis is, but, you know, a little better offensive player. So they're going to, you know, they're going to really be relying on Ellis to kind of, you know, help further develop JT, as well as be a productive bat when he gets in the lineup on the days he gets the nod.
Now, how about reading on the site a little bit, Joe, how about Realmuto getting tried out a little bit at first base maybe during spring training just to get him away from the plate a little bit? Is that a possibility?
Yeah. Michael Hill, the president of baseball operations, has kind of floated this around since the winter meetings that, you know, of course, you know, Posey does it in San Francisco, that, you know, the Marlins don't really have yet, and I'm not sure they're going to get one, that right-handed, you know, complement to Justin Bour at first base. Now, I don't think it'd be a stick platoon where he'd go there all the time. I also think if you're going with a thin bench, you know, you got Ellis is, like I said, a little more offensive-minded than Mathis, so they feel like to go with him behind the plate and then occasionally get JT and, you know, keep his bat in the lineup. If it's for 10 games over the year, it'll be real interesting to see if he can handle that. Clearly, he's athletic enough, but keep in mind, he's never played first base. So, you know, I'm sure it's going to be something that spring training we can keep an eye on. They got a really good infield instructor in Perry Hill. You know, clearly one of the best instructors in the game in terms of technique and preparation. And it'll be interesting to see if JT can handle that. You know, it's a move the Marlins will make. Now, I have a couple of reservations about this one, Tim. I'm sure all for the flexibility of playing a lot of positions, especially in the National League, and wanting to preserve a player. You know, JT will turn 26 early in the season. You know, if you can get him off his, you know, out of the crouch and out of the grind. But JT, if there's a knock on him, the defensive framing is a little bit of an issue. You know, he's going to be dealing with a lot of relievers who can get a lot of work. He's dealing with, you know, two, maybe three, maybe even four at times, different starting pitchers than he dealt with last year. And, you know, I just wonder if they're going to put too much on his plate. You know, you'd hate to see him take a step backwards defensively and as a catcher because he's focused on first base.
The other catcher on the 40-man roster is Tomas Tolis. Hit his first major league home run, I think, on the last day of the season in 2016. I assume he is headed to AAA most likely to start the season. How ready is he for the big leagues?
Well, they say his bat is ready. He's a switch hitter, hit really well. I think he hit over 300 in AAA last year. And, you know, he's a guy who is more of an offensive-minded catcher than defense. And, you know, if they want to, they could possibly carry him on the big league club and then do a little bit more of what we were talking about, JT at first, perhaps even Talese getting some time at first and still kind of be protected, you know, instead of having both of your catchers in the game, because if something were to happen to somebody, it really puts you in a shorthanded situation. So Talese is a guy who, if his defense picks it up, is ready for the big leagues. But, you know, his bat, from all indications, is pretty much there. So they at least got offensive depth, you know, at that position. So Talese could be an interesting guy to see if this guy is ready to kind of contribute in a part-time basis, however the role might be.
These catchers will be dealing with the starting pitchers and also obviously the bullpen. And Michael Hill recently talked about the fact that because they've added so many arms to that bullpen, Joe, and there's a lot of depth there and guys that can do different kinds of things, that we may see the Marlins with maybe a different kind of approach to how they'll use their bullpen in 2017.
Yeah, I think they're going to be a little unconventional or unorthodox, however you want to call it. You know, Michael talked a little bit about being creative, and then he kind of rephrased it to non-traditional. This is a team, we've addressed it before, they don't have the true ace. They've kind of stacked up on threes and four type caliber pitchers. And if these guys aren't going as deep into games, the bullpen is going to be heavily relied on. You know, we saw the playoffs, and everyone knows you can't do that over 162, which is correct. If you're using the same two or three pitchers, you can't use Andrew Miller three innings a night over 162 in Cleveland. But the Marlins feel with, you know, there's a really good chance they're going to carry eight relievers and a 13-man staff. So, and then this team's got two or three big league ready depth to come up from AAA. So they're going to have about 10 or more relievers who can contribute. So I think they're really going to look at analytics on their starters, and they're going to look at matchups. And if they're going to go an inning and two thirds with, you know, with somebody one night, they, you know, that guy may get a couple of days off, but they have reinforcements to kind of patch up, you know, their bullpen. So I think it's kind of funny, we talk pace of play in this sport, but I think the Marlins and Don Mattingly could be going to a spend quite regularly and in situations that you didn't normally see in the past, while you just say, hey, let my starter go six no matter what, or seven no matter what, because he's got to learn to do that. They might be doing a little bit more mixing and matching of relievers in that regard.
Well, it was a big storyline, obviously, throughout the postseason with what the Indians were able to do, and it'll kind of be a growing thing around baseball. We'll see how the Marlins monitor that bullpen throughout the season. Something to watch for this 2017 team. Great stuff as always, Joe. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Marlins edition. For Joe Fresaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Braves reporter, Mark Bowman. Mark, we're talking starting rotation on the podcast this week, and it's certainly an intriguing starting rotation when you look at the new additions to this Braves rotation and the veteran pitchers there. I think it's going to be a real entertaining rotation to watch as well, and we'll see as the season goes along if some of the young guys can kind of earn their way into that. But let's start at the top, and despite the additions of R.A. Dickey and Bartolo Colon, Jaime Garcia, Julio Teheran is the ace. I think he earned that title a year ago. I don't know if he's the long-term ace of this staff. He'll be a guy in there, but right now, best option as far as that number one. What do the Braves expect from him in 2017?
Yeah, Tim, I think you kind of laid it out perfectly there. I mean, I think what you saw from Julio Teheran is the capability of serving as a legit number two and or number three in many rotations last year. Now within this rotation, I think he is with the number one. You know, the Braves certainly hope to see him live up to that expectation or to that level. And you know, if he pitches like he did throughout most of last year, you know, he certainly will be that anchor that they need at the top of the rotation. You know, we saw him through the first 3 months last year earn that all-star status, you know, which we saw from him in June right before he had that infected hair. They plagued him for a start or two. Now you're thinking, okay, is this guy may even get some Cy Young votes? And he was pitching that effectively. And what was the difference last year was that, you know, that he was the command of his fastball. That's where everything starts. You know, he was commanding his fastball better, but he had a much better feel for his secondary pitches. His slider became a weapon again. You know, we're never going to see that guy that was touted, I don't think, back during his high, you know, top prospect days, the guy that was throwing 94, 95 with the, you know, good slider and the other secondary stuff. But, you know, he proved last year and even back in 2014 that he can be successful right there at 90, 91. You know, and just because of his advanced knowledge of knowing how to attack hitters at this age, I think that he has proven that he has the, you know, a good sense of how to attack hitters, and that's going to keep him around the game for a long time. You know, over the next few years, we're probably going to see bigger and better arms that might, you know, become more of that legitimate ace of that staff. But with Teron locked up here for the next few years, he certainly serves as a valuable anchor, not only for this year, but you know, in the years to come as the Sean Newcombs and go all the way down to the Colby Allards as they start arriving and have that potential to step up and be the ace. You know, you look at the rest of the rotation, Bartolo Colon coming off another, you know, very consistent season there with the Mets with R.A. Dickey. He did struggle last year, you know, but you look at his home and road splits. He had a 3.43 ERA, I believe, on the road. So, you know, having a chance to pitch outside of the dome may be beneficial. He may get back to the consistency he showed in previous years where he's a guy that eats 200 innings every year. And that's really what they went out and got Colon and Dickey for. And they wanted two guys that could eat innings as they started to, you know, bring in, you know, as they had somewhat of a young rotation around them. Now, obviously, the rotation, you know, added more experience after those two guys arrived when they acquired Jaime Garcia. And Garcia is a bit of a question mark, you know, because of his health history. But if he pitches effectively early in the year, you know, he's a guy that they could flip and then maybe make a spot for the Aaron Blair, Matt Whistler, Patrick Weigel, Sean Newcomb, you know, those guys that are knocking on the door and that might be ready by June or July.
Yeah, certainly question marks with Garcia. And with the Dickey and Colon signings, I thought early, they took care of that early on as if those, you know, those guys were clear targets and they took care of it. Garcia came a little bit later. If you throw those guys in with Teron, there's four starters. Is Mike Foltynewicz set to be the other guy in this mix as far as five guys to start the season?
Well, what the Braves are going to say, you know, Aaron Camp, you know, he needs to win that this spot, and that's fine. I mean, you got to say that. And, you know, you don't want to have a guy at this early stage of his career feeling like anything's handed to him. But at the same time, unless he absolutely has a terrible spring or, you know, suffers some kind of injury, I don't see how you could give that spot to Whistler or Blair and not him. And let's take it a step further. Okay, so now you say, okay, what about John Danks or Cole Mentor? Okay, well, you still have to take a look at the big picture here. I think that they're already taking, you know, kind of risking the future a little bit by putting Whistler and Blair at Triple-A level to start the season. I think you have to add at least one of these guys to the rotation because you don't want to go into 2018 with a bunch of guys that are going to be enduring growing pains, you know, in having to learn the lessons that you really can only learn at the big league level. Yes, you can develop at the minor league level, but there are lessons that you can only learn when you're there in the big league. So I think you've got to set up the possibility that, you know, Foltynewicz is going to have every opportunity to make, you know, 30 starts or at least somewhere in that vicinity. And at some point this year, I you know, like I said, whether you flip Garcia or Colon or Dickey, I think at some point in time you may have to create another spot for at least one of those other guys so that when you go into 2018, you aren't once again burdened by the youth in your rotation that they felt last year. And, you know, I get it. You're moving into a new stadium. You want to win this year. You go out and get these veteran guys. At the same time, you motivate some of your young kids, like Whistler and Blair, by telling them, hey, look, nothing's guaranteed. You're going to have to earn your way back up here. And that's fine. But at the same time, if they prove they're ready, I don't think that they can be in a position where they're blocking their path back to the big league level for any significant length of time. And the same goes with in regards to Newcomb and Weigel and Max Fried coming quickly. You know, he's going to start at the Double-A level. He's never pitched there before. But at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised at some point this summer we'll talk about, hey, is this guy ready to make the jump?
You mentioned Whistler and Blair a lot there, and obviously they're kind of those next guys in line. And it's been made clear by the moves the Braves made the offseason that they're most likely, unless they're absolutely lights out in spring training, starting the year in AAA. How will those guys handle that? Because they're almost back where they were a year ago, you know, trying to make this team. But maybe they, when you talk about Whistler, maybe there's less of a chance now than there was a year ago of him being part of a rotation.
Well, I think he's the one that probably, if you're saying which one should be more angry with this direction, I think he may be the one. You know, Aaron Blair had his opportunities last year. You know, it wasn't out of question that, hey, maybe he would stumble a little bit last year and that there was a possibility he would have to start this year in AAA. There was never a guarantee he was going to stick. But at the same time, Whistler has been within this Atlanta rotation for a significant portion of both of the past two seasons. Yes, he struggled throughout June, July last year. When he came back in August, I thought he pitched pretty effectively. And, yes, there was a start or two there in September after he had tweaked his oblique where he may have been battling some rust or shaking off some rust. But at the same time, you know, I think that he's the one guy that has to be saying, hey, you know, don't forget about me. You know, what more can I prove? But at the same time, I think that, you know, he's one guy that if he just gets a little bit more mental toughness about him, you know, maybe enhances his confidence there on the mound, you know, becomes more aggressive with his approach, I think he has a long career ahead of him. I really like his intelligence, his pitching IQ. They're just a little bit, some portions of his game that I've heard some of the coaches and the scouts talk about were, you know, just the pitchability and aggression level, I think, are the two things that he has to focus on. And, you know, hey, maybe this little kick in the rear will be exactly what he needs and to get back on that path that he's shown that he can travel both the past two seasons, because there have been stretches where he's shown that he could be at least a solid number three or number four for many years at this level.
Yeah, hopefully the motivation certainly pays off, and it's, I think, a good tactic. You don't want a guy to get comfortable either. One more thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, Mark, here on the podcast. Blaine Boyer, Emilio Bonifacio, non-roster invites to this team. What are the chances of one or both of those guys earning a spot on this roster?
Well, you know, with Bonifacio, I was somewhat surprised to hear him thrown in the mix. You know, when he signed in December, I was actually surprised he signed back with the Braves. You know, he spent most of last year with Gwinnett. You know, he was affected, or he put up some good numbers there, but at the same time, you know, his big league results weren't impressive in any sense. And obviously, he had struggled the year before with the White Sox. So I was somewhat surprised that they went that route and that he wanted to come back here. But at the same time, from what I hear, that he's certainly right there in the mix and maybe should be considered one of the favorites for the bench job. If they like his, you know, he's a switch hitter with some speed and has that ability to play center field. They have some other options to play center field if necessary. You know, Vince Yorke's out for any extended period of time with Peterson or Rodriguez. Either one of those guys could move out there, even Darno. But at the same time, I think they just kind of want to have a guy like Bonifacio on their bench, from what I understand. So if he has a decent spring, I do expect him on the roster. As with Boyer, he was somewhat of a late sign here a week or so ago. But, you know, he obviously wanted to pitch here in his hometown. This is a chance, you know, this is going to be his only opportunity to be a part of the first season of SunTrust Park. He's got a couple. Some young children here that he's been moving around here the last few years, San Diego, Minnesota, and Milwaukee. You know, there are no guarantees with that minor league deal, but at the same time, I think he was confident enough in his own abilities and also interested in this opportunity to keep his family at home to take this chance that he now has. You look at the bullpen mix, and you have Jim Johnson, obviously, there at the top. And if Rodas Biscaino's healthy, as everybody expects he's going to be, he's the guy that could be their top setup guy. You got Cabrera, Ramirez, Kroll, Jazz Rowe. And then Paco Rodriguez is probably, if he comes back from Tommy John effectively, then he's probably their one guy that could be used as a lefty specialist. So you're running out of numbers even with them using an eight-man pen, especially when you throw in Romero, the Volpe pick from the Cubs. But at the same time, you know, I think the Braves may use this depth to either make a trade or, you know, maybe take one of these younger guys. It would probably have to be Cabrera because you got Rowe, Kroll, and Ramirez all out of options. You know, maybe they start him back at the minor league level. You know, here's a guy that's throwing 100-plus. You know, if he throws strikes as consistently as he did last year, that'd be pretty hard to do. But at the same time, I think they're very interested in having Boyer's experience there in their pen, some leadership. So, you know, whether it's via trade or maybe Rivera doesn't make the club, if nothing else, Boyer provides some insurance. But at the same time, I will not be surprised if he is also in that Atlanta bullpen on opening day.
Great stuff, Mark. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Braves edition. For Mark Bowman, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here again with Todd Zalecki, our MLB.com Phillies reporter. As we make our way around the roster, we continue along with the infield this week, Todd. It's an exciting spot for this Phillies team, and it's bound to get more exciting as maybe this season goes on, if not certainly in the near future, as more prospects make their way up to the major leagues. But let's get right into it. Let's start at the hot corner because Maikel Franco is obviously a key guy on this roster because the Phillies need to know what he is. He's certainly shown the flashes of being an all-star caliber player, but not all the time. When you look at the Phillies' big picture, how important is Maikel Franco to this entire rebuild?
He's huge. I'm not going to say, like, you know, it's make or break for the Phillies if Maikel Franco pans out or not, but you look at the rest of the organization and what's kind of coming up through the system, they don't really have a superstar, I guess, third base prospect, like, knocking on the door, whereas they have those guys at shortstop, second base, first base, outfield, rotation, bullpen, catcher. Third base is kind of one spot where, you know, they don't have a guy at AAA, you know, like I said, knocking on the door. So they really need Maikel Franco to put together a better season. And it's funny because, you know, he had 25 home runs last season. He had 88 RBIs, I believe, but yet his OPS was around like 740, 750 or something. Not very impressive, you know, when you think about a guy that played every single day, and you think about a guy that hit in the middle of the lineup and, you know, a guy that's supposed to be kind of a cornerstone of the lineup for years to come. So, but when you talk to Matt Klentak and Pete McCann, they like to remind everybody that, you know, that was last season was really his first full season in the big leagues. And at times I think he felt a lot of pressure to live up to the hype and to produce. And quite frankly, there were stretches where he was kind of really swinging out of his shoes a lot, just really chasing some bad pitches, over swinging and, you know, trying to hit home runs every single time he went up. When, you know, Pete McCann on the point is like, you know, if Maikel just wanted to hit a couple line drives for doubles, you know, those help out the team too. So the Phillies really expect him to take a step forward this season. You know, they expect him to hit for a higher average, higher slugging, higher on-base percentage, all that stuff, and continue to improve at third base. Quite honestly, I have no reason to think he can't do that. I do think that he underachieved last year. So, you know, I'm in the boat of, you know, Maikel Franco has a lot more in him, and he could play a lot better than he played last year.
You mentioned him swinging for the fences. How much of that do you think could have been just because this team struggled so much offensively that maybe he felt pressure that he had to be that guy that was hitting home runs because really 1-9, nobody else really was. So if he was in a lineup that was scoring runs a little more regularly, do you think he'd have an easier time settling in and looking for that line drive?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where some of these other players, you know, that's why they kind of brought in Michael Saunders on a 1-year, $9 million deal. And, you know, that's why they're hoping for big things from Tommy Joseph and the rest of the lineup. I do think that he saw the team struggling. I do think that he kind of looked at how he did 2 years ago when he came up in, I guess it was like mid-May, really played well until he suffered a hand injury in August and missed much of the second half. He was really impressive for a rookie. And I think he was trying to live up to those expectations. And when the season starts and the team's not scoring and you're not swinging
well, sometimes those things can snowball on you, and I think that's the case with him.
The middle infield on this team is interesting. Obviously, you have Freddy Galvis at shortstop, Cesar Hernandez at second base, two guys who have shown that they can hold down those positions, but knocking on the door pretty soon is going to be J.P. Crawford, which will kind of mix things up. But you would think opening day, it'll be Galvis and Hernandez. So as far as Freddy Galvis goes, how big a year is this for him because of Crawford's, you know, approach?
Yeah, this is huge for Freddy Galvis. And it's kind of interesting because there's a lot to love about Freddy Galvis. Defensively, I think, you know, he could have won a gold glove last year. He was that good. I mean, he was all over the field, made every type of play. He's a very smart baseball player. He's a good presence in the clubhouse. He hit 20 home runs last season. But he also had the worst on-base percentage of any qualified hitter in baseball last year, 274 on-base percentage. So, you know, while the 20 home runs are nice, I asked Pete McCann, I said, wouldn't you rather have Freddie cut his home runs in half, hit about 8 to 10, and have his on-base percentage be 320, 330? He said, absolutely. And I think Freddie, late last season, I asked him about that, and he acknowledged that he needs to see his on-base percentage go up. And that is going to be the determining factor, I think. If Freddie goes out next season and he continues to play great defense and he's hitting for some power, but he's still hitting 230, 240 with a 270 on-base percentage, and J.P. Crawford is in AAA hitting 280 with a 360, 370 on-base percentage, because J.P. Crawford, Phillies GM Matt Klentak talks about this all the time. He controls the strike zone as well as anybody. He's almost, I think he's walked like 230 times and struck out 240 times in his minor league career. Great plate discipline, great eye. If those things are happening, and say it's June, right, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure to call up J.P. Crawford. So Freddie has to really, really improve in terms of his ability to get on base. And if he does not, then some decisions are going to have to be made, and he's going to either become a utility infielder or you know, find somewhere else he's going to have to go.
And maybe that other spot is second base, which would mean Cesar Hernandez becomes that utility man. And maybe, I mean, is that his best role? When you look at him as a player, Todd, I feel like he doesn't have, as valuable as he's been at times for the Phillies, he doesn't have that look of a regular, everyday guy on a contending team. Is this team better off maybe if in the future it's Crawford at short, Galvis at second, and then Hernandez gets to move around and be that utility guy?
You know, there is a school of thought, I think, in the organization of that scenario kind of playing out. But at the moment, I think Cesar Hernandez, the fact that he got on, he really finished the season hitting the ball very well and getting on base. I think he was like 22nd in baseball and on base percentage. Matt Klentak is a big Cesar Hernandez fan. But like I said, there was some talk last year of, you know, because everybody's been kicking around, you know, when Crawford comes up, what happens? Like, where are the moving pieces? And one of those scenarios is Freddy Galvis moving to second base. But at the moment, based off the way Freddy hit last year and the base stumped on the way that Cesar hit last year, I think it would almost have to be a situation where Freddy really boosts his on-base percentage, like we talked about, and Cesar would have to kind of come back to earth a little bit, you know, and, you know, be kind of have his offensive numbers even out with Freddy. In other words, if Freddy and Cesar are the same offensive player, I think there's not a question in my mind that the Phillies go with Freddy Galvis, because kind of what I mentioned earlier, he's very smart in the field. Cesar makes a lot of mental mistakes, and Freddy is a superior defensive player. Not saying that Cesar's not a good defensive second baseman, but Freddy is, he's lights out defensively. So if those two guys kind of, you know, even out offensively, I think there's definitely a situation where then Cesar can be kind of a bench player. But the difference there is Cesar is not as good defensively, like I mentioned, so he's not as quality of a shortstop or even as a third baseman as Freddie would be if Freddie's moving around the field. So that kind of creates another dilemma for the Phillies if it gets to that point.
Yeah, very good point there. And then at first base, obviously, maybe the official changing of the guard now with Ryan Howard no longer part of this roster. Tommy Joseph will take over there in 2017. But there's more talent on the way there as well. Rhys Hoskins had a great season last year in Reading with the power bat. But for now, is this Tommy Joseph's job day in, day out? Are they going to look to work some kind of platoon, or is it his job to win or to lose, I guess?
You know, I think it's his for sure. You know, Matt Klentak said that at the winter meetings. He says, right now we look at Tommy Joseph as our everyday first baseman. We like what we saw last year. We want to see more of it. You know, and Tommy, we talked to Tommy last week here in Philly, and, you know, he said all the right things. Like, listen, I'm not going to camp thinking I've got a job. I'm out there to win a job, which is a great attitude to have, you know. But really, he's the only option right now. A lot of people have wondered if Brandon Moss, the Phillies had signed Brandon Moss over Michael Saunders, then you might be talking more of a platoon situation. But now that Saunders is in the fold and he's never played first base before, I think Tommy Joseph is going to get the vast majority of at-bats at first base. You know, Howie Kendrick has played some first base before, but talking to Pete McCann the other day, he says he doesn't want to screw with Howie Kendrick. You know, he just wants to put him in left field, let him concentrate on left field, you know, produce offensively, and just leave him out there. So, you know, then naturally the question we followed up with is, you know, who's going to play first base if Tommy needs a day off? And you mentioned Andres Blanco as a guy that can play some first base. So if Andres Blanco is going to be playing some first base over anybody else, to me that says they're just going to let Tommy go out there and prove himself. If Tommy would struggle this year, if he doesn't make the adjustments that he needs to make, and Rhys Hoskins is tearing the cover off the ball in AAA, then I think is when things are going to start to get interesting, because, you know, Rhys and Dylan Cousins were the Phillies' co-minor league players of the year, and Rhys has really shown a good knack for hitting and kind of sniffing out those RBIs. So that's going to be another kind of fun situation to watch. But I like talking to Tommy. He seems to have a good feel for hitting, and, you know, what kind of piques my interest in him is, you know, he shows a lot of interest. I wrote about this yesterday, actually, on Phillies.com, how he really kind of digs into some of the numbers. You know, he said he, in the offseason and late last year or whatever, he kind of Googled, like, some of the best hitters in baseball and their philosophies on walks and on base percentage and OPS and stuff, and he said he kind of took some of that to heart. I asked him last season about some of the StatCast numbers, like exit velocity. He says he definitely looks at those things, and he kind of compares his exit velocity with other, you know, left-handed hitters, you know, other right-handed hitters, and to kind of maybe compare swings and see, like, all right, well, Chris Bryant, you know, he looks at Chris Bryant, he's like, all right, well, Chris Bryant hits the ball this hard, you know, what can I do with my swing to kind of mimic his or whatever? And, you know, that just kind of shows a real open-mindedness to improving, and for that reason, I'm going to be really interested to see if he can kind of carry over what he learned last year into this year.
Yeah, like a forward-thinking guy for sure. You mentioned Andres Blanco, and the good thing with him, he can play all four infield positions, which is certainly valuable for this team when guys need days off. It's going to be an interesting infield to watch as the season progresses, and I'm sure Phillies fans will be keeping an eye on the Major League Club and then some of those names making their way up that'll probably be starting the year at the Lehigh Valley as well, with an eye to the future. Great stuff as always. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Phillies edition. For Todd Zalecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week.
MLB.TV Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.TV Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details.